Okay, Ken Kellerman. I'm here with Coach Umenin, Dave Hogg, and Sierra Smith. It's July 27th. And Coach, you know, we're not trying to do personal interviews of the life of people or anything, but it's NREO that we're interested in, the history of NREO and how it got started. And in your case, we also want to talk about the Harvard days, because so many people who played a big role in the first days of beginning of NREO, you know, came from Harvard, and so perhaps we can start there. But to put things in perspective, can you tell us when you came to Harvard, and where that was with respect to all the other people that we know, Dave Heeshan, Bill Howard, Cam Wade, Nan Dieter, Ray Kasem, you know, the relative seniorities.
Well, when I first became a graduate student in the astronomy department, I transferred from applied science into the astronomy department. Whipple was the chairman of the department. And just before I started in the fall term, I went to see Whipple as the chairman of the department. What background?
What year was that?
That was in 53 summer. What my preparation, what was expected of my background in order to be a graduate student in astronomy. So he gave me a copy of the volume, which was the sort of commemoration of the 50 years of Yerkes Observatory, what was called the Hynek volume, a series of articles by all the Yerkes people previous 50 years, and gave it to me and said, you read through it during the summer and you will be a graduate student. You probably will go through the graduate school, no problem. At the same time, he told me that a radio astronomy project was being started, had already started, and I should go and talk to Bart Bach about the project. And I went to Harvard College Observatory and met with Bach. Bach said, oh, you should go and visit Agassiz Station. We are building the telescope there. So I arranged with Doc Ewan, and Jack Campbell came and took me to Agassiz Station. That was the first time I went. When I went there, I saw the 24-foot building, and top of it, there were two people. One was rubbing the axle of the telescope, smoothing it out, and another one was doing something mechanical on top also. And these two were Heeshan and Lilly, and they were the first graduate students recruited into the radio astronomy program. And so that's the first time I was introduced, and went downstairs, and Doc Ewan told me, your assignment is in your first term, sign up for a course, your assignment is to write an operations manual for the receiver. And so in long hand I went through the circuit diagrams and the operations and the whole thing. I wrote an operations manual for that receiver. And that was the only one ever written for that receiver, and it stayed there until it was closed down. And so then that was 53 fall term. I started. And there was no one else, no other graduate student other than Campbell Wade, who was already there. And the story is, from what Doc Ewan told me, Campbell Wade was the one who was egging on Bach to get into radio astronomy. And even though all the optical astronomers discouraged him, at this age, who do you want to get into this new field, which has, at that time was not supposed to have a future?
Dave Heeshan told us this, confirmed this. Yeah.
This is not
widely known, I think.
Mm-hmm. It has no future.
Yeah.
And where do you want to get into this? So
who said that?
In general, several of the astronomers of that day, I think there was even a card which Walter Wade sent to Bach. He has shown me that card, in which he had a postcard, and he said, "Bach, where do you want at your age get into this astronomy, which has no branch of astronomy, which has no future?" Something to that effect.
And each one had already been found by then, right?
Yeah, it's done.
Yeah. I think that was the general view.
It was found, it was done.
Yeah. But I said, well, they were looking for the spiral structure and they found, that's all. What more is there to be done? That was the attitude.
In your interview with Woody, you mentioned this and you said you had a copy of that letter or postcard. Might you still have it?
Well, I'm not sure I have it. Yeah, because when Bart moved to Australia, he told me, just as Shapley told me earlier, go through all the correspondence and reprints and take away whatever you want. I mean, but at that time I didn't have much space to keep anything, so there hardly anything survived that transition. But it was. Campbell Wade was bothering Bach about wanting to go into radio astronomy. So he sent him to Purcell. I think Purcell sent him to Doc Ewan. So Doc said, after a few times of interaction, he called up Bach and said, if you are really interested, why do you send an undergraduate to me?
Oh, he's an undergraduate.
Campbell Wade was an undergraduate at the time, first started, because
right.
He was in his final year or just finishing at Harvard. Send somebody senior to talk to me about it. And that's how it got started. And then Bart put together, went to, he would not say Mrs. Agassiz, to get some money for the project.
Campbell was older because of his military service.
Yes. Yeah. And he had a little more exposure to at least some elementary parts of electronics, whereas Dave, as he put it, he knew how to grease all the trucks on the parking lot of the where he was during his recruitment, I mean, those 2 years. But he did not have any exposure to any other aspects during the military life. But Campbell Wade had some exposure to electronics, so
he was an artillery officer.
Cam.
And so he might have had radar and,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
Telecommunications.
So
that's why he was deaf.
I didn't know they were.
Yeah. One ear from the side that faced the artillery piece.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Lilly also did not have much of a background in electronics at all. So, Doc Hewitt.
What about you?
But I had fair amount of, you know, he had been building the transmitters, I mean, the, for ionospheric work from scratch. We got in India when I started as a research assistant in the Department of Communication Engineering, a huge amount of World War II surplus equipment. And we had to order all these from catalogs as thick as these. I didn't know what was what. And they were being sold to the educational institutions in India at almost nominal prices. One of them was the most advanced radar built during World War II, which was SCR-584. It was a 10-centimeter radar. And the original packages with the parachute dropping equipment and all that, we got the whole thing. I think we paid at that time the equivalent of about $25 for the whole thing. But Westinghouse, which built it, had charged the federal government $50,000 for each package. We got it for about $25. I put it together, so I had some amount of background, and myself and my fellow student, our assignment was to build an ionospheric transmitter for studying the
vertical incidence.
Yes, because my professor with whom we worked, his background was in ionospheric transmission properties of the ionosphere and things like that. And it just so happened at that time, Olaf Rydbeck came through India. He had come for the same Indian Science Congress, which Taffy Bowen had come for the same meeting. So Rydbeck came to the lab and he saw our breadboard assembly of the equipment. And he gave a talk on ionospheric work because they worked on this so-called triple splitting of the ionospheric echoes. So that, so I had some experience in hardware. So Doc Ewan said, "You are the hardware man." And Jack Campbell was the only technician.
Tell us more about Jack. Because he was a graduate student, wasn't he?
Jack?
Yeah.
No.
Oh.
He worked for Doc Ewan. Ewan Knight Corporation, the company was in existence at that time, and he worked as a technician for the company, building other things in addition to this, but this was his major assignment. So it was Jack who used to give me a ride from Cambridge. He lived in the outskirts of Cambridge and used to give me a ride to Agassiz Station. And so Dave Hewson, by that time, the receiver was in operation in the dish. Also just started operating. And of course, there was not a pressure, but hope that something very interesting will come through. And the receiver technology, particularly the DC comparison radiometer, that had never been tried before, and how it would work. And it was all a real jerry-rig operation. But it worked, even though it took an hour and a half for one megahertz scan. But it worked. It was a very clever scheme. I mean, I'm still trying to get the name of that Walter.
I think it was Shalal. There was a great physicist, Shalal, S-C-H-A-L-O-W. Was that guy?
He was.
Well, I shouldn't have said that.
It was in my thesis. I had given the reference to that paper, which he wrote in the Review of Scientific Instruments. he wrote that paper.
We can track it down.
Yeah.
The ionosphere sounder that you built in India, it was a swept frequency?
Yes.
So that technology for sweeping frequency, then
well,
you
but that
used?
It was not any electronics switching like that. It was
mechanical pruning?
Mechanical.
Capacity?
Yeah.
But wasn't that what you did for H1?
No, H1, it's a very complicated system which what was used was, you know, the IF was fed to that the low frequency IF. I think it was 450 kilohertz or something that IF in those days for short wave receivers.
All AM receivers. Yeah.
It was fed to a Hallicrafter communication receiver, and the scanning was the L band cavity, which was a World War II product, which Doc Ewen had obtained from somewhere. A hole was drilled on the surface of the cylinder, and the perpendicular shaft was put in, and it was driven by a small mortar. So as you plunged the thing into it, the oscillator cavity, the frequency of the oscillator was changed. So the local oscillator frequency for mixing was changed by moving the shaft up and down into the L-band cavity. And what came out after the second conversion into the Hallicrafter receiver then was tracked again with a mortar driving the dial in the Hallicrafter receiver. So it was a tracking that, and then there was a servo control which went from there to the plunger. So the plunger was changing the local oscillator frequency, and then as the IF changed, instead of the scanning actually was done in the Hallicrafter receiver, and there was a servo to control the total scanning. And that was a very tricky affair because you had to scan it and get on the side of the wave, the band shape of the second oscillator, I mean second mixer. And it was a very tricky thing to lock it. You had to bring it and then switch it on. And only a couple of us who could do it. And so that was the introduction to the that particular receiver, but it worked, even though it took a long time for scan. And Dave, and as far as the topics which were interesting was, nobody knew what exactly to look for. I mean, it's true that Leiden and the Australians had obtained signals, but what to do with those? What to expect from those? And with the background in interstellar matter, Bock had, I mean, he felt that there should be interesting things if you look in the plane of the Milky Way, but he had a fairly clear policy that he will not suggest a topic to any graduate student. He has to come up by themselves. And that, I think throughout his career, he rarely published a paper with his student. Rarely. He had a few, but it was rare. I published only just one, and that too, not because he suggested a topic or anything. He actually contributed. He did the galaxy counts for determining the absorption of the those dark clouds. Mm-hmm. And I did the 21 centimeter, and Bob Lawrence from who came from Denver, I mean from the Bureau of Standards.
Boulder.
Yeah. He was sent to Harvard for a year or something like that.
No, actually, he was in Washington. Bureau of Standards in Washington.
Yeah. But he came as a visitor, sort of, for a year. So we published a paper, Bob Lawrence and Menon. But Bach always liked the idea of the alphabetical order of the authors with the name V.
Very favorable.
But very rarely he published. Actually, I don't think he ever published anything with Hishan or Lilly or as a co-author, or for that matter, anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
In the radio astronomy program, as a co-author, he never published anything.
You mentioned Tom Matthews earlier.
Yeah, Tom Matthews was already a graduate student. He had done his master's at Indiana, I think. Was it right? Yeah. So he joined just about the same time, but he was a sort of freelancer in the sense that he didn't have to work for a degree, kind of, as you know, the Matthews clan in Toronto did not work for a living. So he had very wide interest, read very widely, and can suggest topics for research to anybody, but he will take his own time.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with his family background. What?
Well, we used to joke,
yeah,
that Matthews owned half the mines in Canada. The Matthews clan, we used to call him. He came from a very wealthy background from Canada.
But you say he didn't have to work. I mean, he still had to work for his degree.
But
he didn't have any financial
incentive.
Right. He paid his own tuition or something.
Paid his own tuition, and he was one of the few graduate students who had a car, and he lived very well in an apartment, not like other graduate students. But he was such a nice person that he got along very well. I mean, we were particularly friendly because he was still a bachelor at that time, and during the observing and all that, he earlier, before I had a car, he gave me rides, and so he, and we had a very extensive background in astronomy.
Yeah, his thesis wasn't in radio astronomy, was it?
Yes.
What was it?
He was the galactic structure in the Perseus Psalm, I think, if I recall correctly. Yeah, it was. He published, there was an ABJ paper he published. But he was very well informed in optical astronomy. He has a very strong background.
Was he an undergraduate at Toronto?
No, he was. He had a master's from Indiana. Maybe he was originally from Toronto.
That sticks in my mind because I think I remember the Toronto people.
Yeah,
speaking.
He may have done his undergraduate at Toronto and then went to Indiana to his master's. And I think that's where he met Anne, his wife-to-be. And she also came, she worked as a research assistant to Shapley.
I saw Tom a month or so ago.
Yeah, I have not seen him for a long time.
I know, neither had I for, many decades. But he's still living in the Maryland area.
Yeah.
And
Years ago, maybe 20, 30 years ago, he had his Kerr was sort of getting white even at that time, but the last time I saw him, it was so white that I couldn't recognize him.
And I recognized him right away.
But
you know, he played a big role in the discovery of quasars, and that's why I was
We had the thesis exams the same day.
Ah.
Same time, because the other person, I had the exam in the morning. In the afternoon, there was another person I don't want to tell about because he became notorious in Washington.
He was Campbell's particularly.
Campbell
would
know.
He died in the last year.
Yeah, he died.
In the last year, I think.
Tom had a little earlier, because Tom was in a little bit of a hurry, because he had already the postdoc at Caltech, so he wanted to go and join. So
what year was that then?
It must have been in the spring of 56.
That's when you did your
yeah. But see, Dave had already been appointed as the Agassiz radio astronomer, so he was staying. He had not moved to. He was still staying in Ayers, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
I used to see him daily, because he was. I was staying at the Agassiz Cottage at the observatory, so we interacted a great deal at that time. But of course, just about the time Dave came back from Wesleyan University. And took over the job, the talk of a national radio astronomy program had already been in the works, even though none of us were involved directly. All the big wheels were talking about it.
And this was 54,
55. In that period, even Bach was not too closely involved in that. It was Lloyd Menzel and Whipple and Lloyd Berkner, and I'm not sure Purcell was too closely involved at the beginning stages of that. There was a famous radio astronomy meeting in Washington, I think arranged by DTM maybe.
Yeah, because
and
of
Merle
Tew
took a very great
that
interest.
That was in 54, right?
Yeah, Merle Tew took a great deal of active part in that.
And Jesse Greenstein too.
Greenstein.
Yeah, we know quite a bit about that.
Yeah,
from their papers.
Yeah.
In your interview with Woody, you gave the impression that the initiative for this national facility originated at Harvard, with people you just mentioned.
Yes.
Whereas some of the other stuff that we've seen, or at least I had the impression, that they have originated with Berkner. Who asked who?
I think the initiative, at least the talk of a bigger radio astronomy program like that, I think Merle Tew was more active because of the scientific interest, whereas maybe because of the Washington Circle contacts he had. Contacted Lloyd Berkner, maybe, with regard to this national program, who would set it up, who would organize it. I don't think either Menzel or Whipple or certainly not Bach was familiar with the national power structure enough to think of who might initiate it and who might operate it like that. I am sure it was Murtu was more familiar with the possibilities of a national as to who could operate such a thing.
Yeah, but he was later on against it, right?
Yeah, that was it was it didn't go through at that time. But then suddenly, somewhere in 1950 or 1955, on that time, suddenly it bubbled up, this idea of a national center.
Yeah. Well, Menzel wrote this report. That was April of 55, I think, right? My impression is he was asked to write that report by Berkner.
But
that's not clear. That's what I was trying to establish, where the initiative came from.
Yeah, I don't know, because I never met Berkner at that time, or had even heard about Brookhaven and Ashland
right.
Labs. It's possible that Menzel was a commander in the U.S. Navy during World War II. Lloyd was an admiral. So they may have had contacts from that period. It was not through any scientific common interest or anything like that. And Whipple also was involved in some related activities during towards the period in World War II period. Whereas Bach was not in that circle at all.
Was there not some common interest between Berkner and his, didn't he do ionospheric stuff?
Well, Berkner had the scientific background to think of radio program because of his ionospheric work.
No, he also worked with Merle Tube at DTM in radio astronomy.
Yes.
And that's where they presumably got to not like each other.
But not in radio. Berkner did.
He did a little bit.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah, I didn't know.
There was mostly ionosphere.
But at this time, there was all of the development of the solar ionosphere connection. So I would have thought the solar people at Harvard would know about the ionosphere.
Yes. There was, I mean, because of that background, the solar people were very much involved with the providing the information for the ionospheric work and all that. And you must have also received for the Naval Research Lab, the NRL people already had started, but because of their 50-foot dish, they had already started thinking about it. But even though they had not actually started, other than looking at the sun.
But they seem not to have been involved in
any discussions about the scenario, they were not involved.
Which is kind of curious now that you think about it.
Yeah. I think John Hagen had already talked about it, but there was no. Actually, it was somewhat surprising.
Well, Hagen was involved, of course, that's right. I forgot about him.
Because Ed Lilly, after Dave and Ed finished their thesis, that was in 54, 55, it was very quick. I mean, once the observations became available, the two had two separate topics to work on, Ed Lilly and Dave. And so they finished their thesis very quickly. And as far as Ed Lilly was a little more energetic, outspoken type of person. And so could get a job more easily at NRL, whereas Dave was a little holding back. And then Bob used to talk about there were not that many opportunities in radio astronomy as such, but the astronomer at the Wesleyan University, was the Thornton Page? Was he?
Yeah.
No. Who was it?
Thornton Page was in Illinois or
Northwestern. Yes, but no, not Thornton Page. Who was the? There was a optical astronomer.
Where was Van Biesbroek?
Van Biesbroek? No.
Oh.
No, that he was at Yerkes. No, who? There was a. Maybe it was Thornton Page. I can't recall now. He was there at Wesleyan University.
Connecticut.
So Dave was appointed as an assistant professor there.
Oh, I thought it was Ohio.
No,
Connecticut.
I see.
Connecticut.
That's where Dave went.
That's where he went.
So you almost have to put the state in because there are two or three Western.
Yeah, I assume Ohio will.
Ohio,
I know that because they never.
There's Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
Just down the road.
Yes. Mm.
There was a well-known astronomer. I mean, of the same age group as Bach and others, who was at Wesleyan.
Thornton Page was in the Midwest.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Thornton Page was at Yerkes for a while, I know, because he did his thesis on there, but there was another.
Well, that's all right, that's not.
Yeah, okay. So, Dave went there, but he didn't find anything exciting going on, but then suddenly this NRAO sort of thing gelled, and there was a lot of talk about hiring people. I don't know what went on with NSF and all that. I just didn't know anything about what was going on.
Yeah, but that's the main thing we wanted to hear, what you overheard
from
Menzel and Bach.
Bach had written a fairly long report.
Yes.
As to the possibilities radio astronomy. I used to have a copy, but I...
We have a copy.
You have a copy. Yeah. So
it was in Scientific American.
Yeah.
On a national observatory or something like that.
Yeah. And then he went... now, exactly how the radio astronomy project got started at Harvard, because already the money was coming in and a position was created. Mrs. Agassiz gave the money for 1 year. She said first only 1 year. And at a princely salary of $5,000 a year.
For you?
No, Dave.
Oh, for Dave.
For Dave. And
that was good money back then.
Yeah, good money.
That was after, I mean, so that was in addition to or after she had paid for the telescope?
Yes. No, the telescope was already under construction at that time.
Had Sam Goldstein come by then?
Oh, Sam came later. He came. He was already working from Stanford. He was working with the solar project, the astronomy project. in Texas, Harvard Station, Texas. Only after he finished his degree with Stanford from the project in Texas, then he came to Harvard. So then when Dave had been there for a year, and the NARAO thing, whole thing became firmer, and who are going to be the first staff for this. And as I recall it, even though I was not in the actual discussions, I did not even know that such things were being talked about. Suddenly, Block said that Dave is coming back to, Dave had been at Harvard, that Dave is going to be appointed to NRAO staff. I understand there are going to be only two staff members, possibly two, and there were two people in contention. One was from NRL.
McLean?
Ed McLean, or Dave Heeshan. And finally, I think Dave was selected. The question was, Ed McLean had a lot more experience in electronics. But whether you want an astronomer or a physicist, engineer, Dave got the job. But that affected my status at Harvard because I had just, I had already the postdoc at Berkeley, agreed to, and I had even booked my flight to go to Berkeley. I had not submitted the thesis at that time. Then when I went to the immigration people in Boston and told them that for my student visa I have to change to some other type of visa if I am going as a postdoc at Berkeley. And that immigration officer, he said, do you want to go from here in Boston? Can't you stay on here? The student visa is a very good type of visa to have. Go and find out. We want you to stay here.
The immigration guy said that.
The immigration told me, I would rather have you stay here instead of going to that place in California.
It's a foreign.
Something like that. So I came back that afternoon and told Bach. Bach had already written to Donald Shane, who was the director of LIC, because I had arranged with George Herbig. I was going to work on Tetare stars. And Bach said, well, now you can't go because Dave is leaving us. There is nobody to run the telescope. I mean, someone who could twiddle the knobs. So you have to stay here. So I said, okay.
That would have been 50...
Late 55, early 56. At least 6 months before I was to submit the thesis. Actually, I had finished my thesis by 55 fall, but Bach told me, don't submit the thesis yet, because then you will have to go and we won't have anyone to run the place. So I put it away and started to work on some other projects. So he, and Dave was appointed to NRAO. Of course, there was no place to go to. NRAO was only a paper organization. He stayed on it.
It wasn't in 1955, 50s. The contract signed in 56. Was it October of 56?
Yes.
But they stayed on at Harvard.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think initially he was a consultant to AUI.
Oh, I see. But he resigned his position, and I got, I was appointed, even though I had no degree. Harvard could do such things in those days. I have a letter from Wenzel. It's unusual for us to offer you this job so well ahead of your submitting the thesis, in the hope that you will submit the thesis. So I stayed on, and Dave stayed on in Ayers. I mean, he had a house there, so he was stayed on for at least another year. I think he had, David Jr. was born in Ayers. I mean, he had Lisa already born, and David Jr. was born in Ayers, Massachusetts. So Dave used to come to the Agassiz station and use that sort of an office like that. And then he finally found Greenbank was selected and all that, and Bach was involved a little more in that process, in the sense he did visit Greenbank, and he tells in great detail the story of visiting Greenbank and going to Trent's store and all that.
Tell us more.
Well, a bunch of foreigners coming into Greenbank. I mean, someone with Bach, you could not. Certainly, you could not have any other feeling other than he doesn't belong there. So, went in the store and asked for to buy something, and he obviously didn't speak the local language. He had difficulty communicating, and he wrote a letter after that visit. And Dave...
A letter to who? About what?
He wrote a letter to us, the group, after a visit.
It was a visit to a foreign country?
Yeah, it was. Visit to a foreign country. But then by
what
that...
What did he say in this letter?
He was, of course, very enthusiastic because he was used to living in isolated places. I mean, Bloemfontein in South Africa, I don't think was any better place than Greenbank. So he lived there for a year, and he had also gone visiting there many times. So for him it was not, whereas the astronomers of that time, radio astronomers and others, for them it was a much more difficult, because many of the people like Whipple and Wenzel and others, they had not lived in isolated areas for a long time since their student days or graduate student days. So for them, it would have been a greater shock. Whereas for Bach was enthusiastic.
Well, he's enthusiastic about everything.
Yeah, well, so he gave a good report. And I don't know whether that influenced Dave to move from Ayers, Massachusetts, which was a not particularly exciting place for him to live.
Before we started, you started to talk about Barth Bach and his relation with other faculty. And
well,
Whipple.
Bach was, you know, he was a pacifist during World War II, which, and as well as Harlow Shapley was, he was a pacifist too.
What do you mean by a pacifist?
That means he did not engage or enroll in any active military service.
Did he have any choice? I mean,
well, the only thing Bach did during World War II related to the military was he taught a course on navigation to servicemen who might get lost.
Sorry,
Bach.
Where was he at the time?
At Harvard.
Ah, he was already here. Okay, I was thinking he was in the Netherlands. That's why I said,
No.
Did he have any choice?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, Bach had come as a postdoc to Harvard in 1920.
Ah, he came there early. Okay, yeah. I should have known that. Yeah,
yeah, late 20s. 20.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, so Bach was not involved. He had been particularly influenced by people like Minette with regard to his political education. Captain Minette and others who were very strong views. But since Shapley and Bach did not get involved directly with any military work, he was not considered by people like Menzel,
right,
and Whipple, who were took very active part, I mean, in mostly in research,
sure,
related,
yeah,
work, but not. And Dick Thomas used to tell me that Menzel was a superlative astrophysicist until World War II started. He said, because his publications on gaseous nebulae really set the standards. But then he started, when he started to work during World War II, he started moving with these admirals and generals and all that. He lost his head. That was his statement.
Sure, who said that?
Dick Thomas.
Oh.
Well, in the middle to late 30s, Menzel, Whipple, and Allen did all of this gaseous nebulae,
yes, yes,
transfer,
yes,
radiation.
Yes, yes. Jim Baker, Jim Baker, and Baker and Menzel, those papers, you
we
know, the standard,
yeah,
the standard papers, we had to read them.
The Society of Fellows, right? They were all in the. Been elected to the,
yes, yeah, yeah. So once he started moving in the high circles, throughout the time I was there, Menzel's work was in the periphery. He never really got into astrophysics as such again.
He was department chair, though, wasn't he?
That he was the director of the observatory.
Director,
yes,
director.
Which Bach had hoped to inherit,
right,
but didn't.
Why?
Again, because of the Menzel had connections with the high level people during the World War II days, and already, to some extent, Harvard wasn't bad. It was considered part of the what do we call it? McCarthy used to call him the Kremlin on the Charles.
I had thought that part of Bach's problem was that he supported Shapley and Shapley's time of tribulation.
Yes.
And got a bad name.
Yes, yes.
With the upper echelon at Harvard because of that.
Yes, that's quite true.
I asked Dave that, he wasn't sure that was true, but that was what I got from,
yeah,
the correspondence between them.
I mean, Shapley certainly got into, but Shapley did it very openly.
Was he a Quaker?
He was not a Quaker as such. he did not really have any open, I mean, something, he was not a Quaker, but as far as, I mean, he was such a close friend of Pope Pius. I mean, actually, that was what finally got him out of trouble, because McCarthy, when he confronted Shapley in the secret hearings and was banging him about his views, and he said, Shapley said, "Senator, oh, I'm glad you have such views. Unfortunately, there are also people who are not so unfriendly with regard to my views." And he produced a letter from Pope Pius and said, in which he said, "Dear Dr. Shapley," and it was a very friendly, personal letter from the Pope. And here was a Catholic senator from Wisconsin haranguing, beating up someone who was a close friend of Pope. that didn't go very well.
And he did Bach did an oral interview at the American Institute of Physics, and there he said that he had been offered the position of NREO director, but he had already had agreed to go to Australia.
Yes.
Do you know anything about this, or?
I don't know the quite the sequence there, because 56, I was appointed Dave's position early in 56. I got the appointment letter from the Harvard trustees, I mean the Society of Fellows. And then 56 was the Radio Astronomy Symposium in Cambridge. Is that right?
Oh, 55, the one that Bach organized?
Oh, 55, yeah, 55. So it was 55 Radio Astronomy Symposium in January.
Yeah.
Joe Posse took him for a walk and sort of sounded him out.
Wait. Oh, about going to Australia?
Yeah, about going to Australia. So he had not thought of Australia until then. And he kept quiet about his thinking and all that, and never talked about it, because all the time we discussed, he was talking about the future of the radio astronomy project at Harvard. But after I was appointed in 56, early in 56, sometime during the next few months, I'm not sure about the date, he called me in and he said, the NRAO, the directorship and the Australian one, there was some conflict in his mind as to whether the NRAO directorship will come through, that whether he would get the support. And I understood from the way he said it that there were people who did not want him as the director. And Priscilla was trying to get him out of the Harvard entanglement and get out, and going out to Australia would be a good thing in that sense, because he gets out of this whole problems at Harvard. And so I don't know who told him that he will not be a candidate. I'm not sure who told him that. And then he agreed to go to Australia.
A little bit surprising, you said approach came from Pawsey, because Pawsey was with CSIRO in Sydney, and I'm not aware of any close relationship with Mount Stromlo or Australian National University.
Well, that's what Joe Pawsey took him up for a walk during that radio astronomy. It was then, it was Joe Pawsey who thought they were talking about Mount Stromlo.
Yeah.
Woolley was retiring, and then suddenly Joe Pawsey popped the question, how about you, Bob? How about you coming over and taking over?
When was that meeting? Wasn't 55. It was earlier, wasn't it? The two meetings.
I know 54 one in Washington. I don't know. That's the DTM.
Yeah, okay, but just a few weeks before that, it was the meeting. Yeah, it's 54. There was a meeting that Bach organized in Cambridge. It was at the, I call it the AAAS squared, because it was sponsored by the American Association for the Advancement.
Oh, this is a radio astronomy.
Yeah, and it was held in the building of the American Institute in Cambridge. American Academy of Arts and Sciences.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah, Malto and
yep,
Grote
yep.
Was there.
Was
there?
No, he gave a he sent his paper because he said he was too busy observing to come.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I attended that.
You did?
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah, I attended that meeting. I was a student.
Yeah, but still.
I attended that meeting. I remember talked, and there were other, it was not just radio astronomy. There was some other talks too at that.
It was the day after Christmas, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that I attended that as a student. We were all...
It was very cold?
Yeah.
It was minus 20 below or something.
Yeah, we all drooped down to Boston. And yeah, I attended that meeting. I mean, I'm seeing these big names for the first time. Yeah.
You don't have any pictures or programs?
No,
leftover?
No. I didn't think I would be in that kind of thing for a while. Yeah, I remember that meeting.
Yeah, well, it was that meeting, I think, and then the one a few weeks later in Washington that really started the ball rolling about the National Observatory.
Yeah, that Boston meeting, I recall. I mean, we were all just way, way out in the periphery.
What about Frank Drake? He was a student.
Yeah, Frank was a year later than I joined, not the same year.
He was a year later than you?
I think it was later. I started my astronomy in 53, the fall. I think he came in 54, he and Mary Jane.
May Captain?
May Cassin
was before
the same year as I did. Yeah. May Cassin. And Mary Connolly, she was Mary Sandage later. Mary Connolly was the same year. She actually had been there a year earlier, just like Tom Matthews. Tom Matthews and Mary Connolly, they were may have been even fellow students in Indiana before they came to Harvard.
About Nan Dieter, she was...
Nan Dieter also came with Drake.
Mary Connolly probably got to know Alan in Illinois.
Alan came to give a set of lectures, or maybe one whole course, when we were there. I forget now which year it was, and that's when Mary Conley was among the group who attended those lectures. I mean, that famous paper of Art Bomb and Sandage. I don't know whether you that had been published, and that was the hot topic of that period. And but I think I had finished my degree by that time when Alan came to give the talks, and then Walter Bardet also came. Same year or another term of that same year. Walter Bardet came and gave a series of lectures. But once Bach left, it happens that the people who had been working for their degrees, suddenly Bach, who was supposed to be the thesis advisor, they all had to find somebody who would be the sponsor for their in the department. And that was a little hard. I couldn't they couldn't imagine me as being, even though officially I was appointed by NSF as the director of the project, NSF project.
But you weren't on the faculty.
I was a lecturer. I was a lecturer.
Uh-huh.
But the first letter of appointment for me was for 1 year. But 3 months later, I got another letter of appointment, making it into a 5-year term. And Harvard apparently had never done that before. I mean, they could do it if they wanted. I have a feeling somehow the NSF must have told Harvard, you can't have a lecturer in astronomy as the director of your project and plan for years ahead. It has to be something firmer than that. So they suddenly decided to make it into a 5-year contract, even though they had no money for it. But they made it into a 5-year appointment. And then the question of who are Drake, I think formally he had Tommy Gold. He had come at that time as his thesis advisor, even though they had not really much contact at that time. May Kasim took Mrs. Kapushkin as the advisor.
What a pair.
And Bill Howard, Fred Whipple called me and said, you are going to be his advisor. I mean, I was just told that, because he was the chairman of the department. And May Kasim, I already said, who else was there?
Dieter.
Oh, Dieter, I think Dieter also, either Mrs. Kapushkin or Tommy Gold became the sponsor. But between, and Cam Wade.
Yeah.
Cam Wade, I'm not sure who was the his sponsor. Possibly Mrs. Kapushkin, I'm not sure.
She didn't know anything about radio astronomy.
No.
That was a formality.
It is a formality.
Well, the same thing happened at Caltech when John Bolton left. I ended up with Gordon, but some of the others ended up with other people in the faculty.
So there are a few hangers-on in the sense that who had started, they finished thesis, and by that time I left, I don't know who were the only...
How did you get along with Gold?
Didn't get along at all.
I knew that, that's why I asked.
No, we got along very well personally.
Uh-huh.
But scientifically, we were good friends, but I couldn't see eye to eye on anything to be done. And he had always his way of doing it, anything. And once I taught him a lesson, after that we got along a little better. One day I was at the Agassiz station. I was, it had rained or snowed the previous, it had snowed the previous night. So the plastic cover on the feed at the focus of the 60 foot was wet. So I had brought the antenna down and climbed up the ladder to change that plastic bag and to clean it up. So Tommy Gold had come and he saw me doing that. And it was taking a little bit of time because it was cold. My hands were, fingers were frozen. And he said, oh, there are better ways of doing it as usual. So I said, okay, Tommy, you come and do it yourself, since you are so experienced. And he came up. It took him an hour and a half in that cold. It was, he was, but, I mean, as friends, he could be very stimulating to talk to, but he wanted his own way. And since I was not a member of the council of the observatory, since I was only a lecturer, he made the decisions. If some decisions had been made, had to be made, project, without informing me, I said, that's not a pleasant situation.
So you think your status as not being on the council had more to do with your seniority or lack of seniority rather than radio astronomy?
Yes, well, I'm probably both part. And also, at the time at Harvard, there were only three professors and no other faculty. There are just three professors.
Shapley, Whipple, and Menzel.
Not Shapley. Menzel, Whipple, and Bock. These were the only three professors. There were no associate professors, no assistant professors, nothing.
Wait a minute, what about Menzel?
Menzel, Whipple, and Bock.
Oh. What about Shapley?
Shapley retired. Shapley retired even by the time I joined, though he was.
I see.
He was in the office.
Gold came as a professor.
When Bock left.
Right. So there's still only three, I see.
Only three in the council.
Oh, that was it.
That's it. And even Mrs. Gaposchkin.
Well, that's a separate story. Yeah, we know that story.
Yeah, that's a different story. But she was not a member of the council.
But she wasn't a professor.
No, she was not a professor.
No, I know. But they could have invited you in as a guest.
Oh, yeah, they could have.
And they didn't.
No, because they all dealt with me as a student.
Yeah.
Who was it who told me, never continue in the same university where you did your doctoral work. You'll always be treated by the senior people as student.
Well, I think it goes both ways. I still feel that way when I go back to Caltech.
Yeah. Well, anyway, but then in 57 or 58, Tommy Gold had been there for a year after Bock left. Then Ben Stromgren came to visit Harvard, and it was widely known among the astronomers of that period that when Shapley retired, the first offer of the job as the director of the Harvard Observatory had been to Ben Stromgren. which he had declined. He didn't want to move Yerkes at that time. And so it was fairly well known. So when Stromgren came to visit Harvard, gave a talk, and I don't know whether you knew Ben Stromgren.
I'd met him, yes.
Met him, but
that's all.
He was not a very inspiring speaker.
Right.
Very quiet, very low voice, very, very nice person. So he wanted to see the radio astronomy project and the Agassiz station. So I drove him out to Agassiz station. And when we were driving out, he told me that Tommy Gold is going to Cornell. I did not know that. So if I had known that a few days or a few months earlier, I forget now, I would not have left Harvard at that time, because it was Tommy Gold's obnoxious behavior that made me leave. Stromgren, of course, was well into the grapevine, so he knew he was leaving. But I don't think anyone among the lower faculty at Harvard knew that Tommy was leaving.
Let's see. What about all the students? How do they get along with each other?
It was in a very exciting time. I mean, the students, because of the particular way the educational system at Harvard worked, particularly in astronomy, we had no classes in the morning, only the afternoon, because we were supposed to be working at Agassiz Station.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were there in the library till 2-3 in the morning. We went to Harvard Square, had breakfast and went to bed. And came back around 11 o'clock and had lunch in the graduate dining hall and came to the office. So practically everyone out there, except one or two of those married people, we were there. And the system there was that all the journals which came in the mail for a week, they were all put together in a box and given to the chairman of the department on Saturday morning. And after he has gone through and noted down of papers of interest, it went on to down the faculty. At the end of the next week, it came to the library. And so the student library, as it is called, Phillips Library. And we were there, the students, reading through every one of them and talking about it, for hours and hours and hours. I think it was a very exciting period. We learned from each other, because the courses were all very informal. But it was a very exciting time. I learned more from fellow students and others. And their reference to, did you read this, or did you read that, and back and forth. That was a very exciting time. And there it was that Tom Matthews played a very good role. He was there a good part of the time during these nightly discussions. And he read every journal,
mm-hmm.
every paper. And all the others too, Campbell Bay, all of us. It was a very exciting time. I can still remember the heated argument with May Cassim or the other fellow students about what that paper did it say it right, and arguing about
things. It was easy to argue with me. Still, you know, and the mirror is just a son.
Yes. I met him.
Yeah.
Many times.
And we see him often.
Meetings. Yeah.
So, you left Harvard in what year?
58.
58, and you went to
Pennsylvania. Yeah. Well, the way that happened was the possibilities at that time were, there were several possibilities. I was considering leaving. The person who knew I was considering leaving Harvard was, of course, Bach. I had written to him at Mount Stromlo, and he had spread the word. I don't know how it got through, but Jesse Greenstein knew that I was probably looking around, and Frank Wood, Bradshaw Wood, who was the director of the head of the astronomy at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, he was at Mount Stromlo at that time on his sabbatical. So Bach might have mentioned to him at that time. Harold Weaver had sent me a return offer at Berkeley. He also knew that I was looking around.
You hadn't thought about NRAO?
No, NRAO, I did not know NRAO was hiring at all.
Maybe they weren't, I mean.
They were not. I don't think so.
Well, were you still in contact at all with Dave Heeshan, or?
Oh, yes. I says that in 56, 57, Dave was still there.
At Harvard? Physically, yeah.
Physically, he was still there, so you were seeing him quite regularly, you know, but I did not know. But as you know, NRAO, when it was being established, was not supposed to have large staff.
Right, right.
And they were talking about...
Those that were meant to be quite technically strong.
Yeah, and I think Merle too played a role in that concept that you could bring equipment and connect it to things there. So that was the area. So I did not, I was not
an
instrument
that.
Builder
right.
Building equipment. So I did not think of NRAO from that point of view.
That changed a year later.
Yeah.
You're only at Penn a year, is that right? Or?
Yeah, yeah. It changed. Then I don't know whether I talked to Dave at that time or not. One of the universities, University of Pennsylvania being one of the AUI, member of the AUI, Bradshaw Wood from Penn, who was at Mount Stromlo, when he wrote to me inquiring about the possibility of coming there, he was of the view that Penn had a very strong electrical engineering department.
Computing.
Yeah. And in microwave technology like that. So there is a good possibility that a collaboration with NRAO could be developed. And J.G. Brainard, who was the chairman of electrical engineering, he was very well known in the field of electrical engineering, had written a textbook and all that. So he contacted Brainard and he said, oh, we will be glad to have a joint appointment in astronomy and electrical engineering, and we can collaborate to build things and take to the radio observatory. So so that was closer to Greenbank, Penn, than any of the other university. So I said, okay, we'll give it a try. But there were, at the same time, I think Jesse Greenstein had written a letter, or somebody had inquired of him, potential candidates from University of Maryland. The chairman of the physics department at the University of Maryland, and who later on was the president of Stony Brook, I forget his name, he's a physicist. He offered a job at the University of Maryland. This was in 57. He wrote in the letter that Jesse Greenstein had suggested that I might be interested. And there again, the idea of building equipment and bringing to Green Bank, being not far away from Green Bank, that was in the back of their mind. But when that offer came, I was either naive or foolish enough to mention it to Menzel, because he already knew that I was might be thinking of moving. And he said, don't go to Maryland. The university has been censured by the AA, American Association of Universities, at that time. So don't go there.
I was familiar with the athletic center. I wasn't aware of
well,
the
I think there was
well.
Because of political interference in the university by the legislature.
State.
Yeah, the state. They were censured them. So he said, don't go there. But when the offer from Penn came, I again talked to Menzel about it. That he was quite happy. Actually, he called the president of Penn, at that time, on Hornwell, the physicist, and he said he wanted to make sure that TIA-CREF contributions and all that will be continued appropriately and all that. He told me how important it is. As a fatherly advice.
You're living on it now.
To some extent. Yeah. Yeah. So he was fatherly advice he gave me. We were good friends. I mean, he was nice in some ways.
Okay. Well, maybe this is a good time to stop.
Yeah.
You can then get on to NRAO.
Okay.
Years after lunch.
All right.
Just hit the stop button.
Oh, the stop button.